22-3134, Butler v. Daimler Trucks North America. Counsel for appellant, if you would make your appearance and proceed.
May it please the court. Good morning. I'm Randy Rhodes, along with my co-counsel Leon Russell, who's in the back of the courtroom from Texas. We represent the five people, the five innocent people, who died in the wreck at issue in this appeal. I never imagined when I graduated law school in 92 that in 2003 I would be in a courtroom arguing about the Elmore case from 1969 and cases of that vintage from California. But here we are. I think it's important to understand the background of this case. We were near the close of discovery in the underlying case. Mr. Kleffner, counsel for DTNA, and I spoke. He had some narrow, focused issues he wanted to raise in a summary judgment motion on behalf of DTNA that would not require expert witness testimony. So we entered into a stipulation. It's in volume one of the appendix, pages 196, 197, right in there. And we stipulated that this is what we're going to do. These issues won't require expert witness testimony, and off we went. And the party scrupulously adhered to that. In footnote 12 of DTNA's first brief, Mr. Kleffner and his team specifically said...
What do you refer to their first brief? You mean on appeal?
No, sir. I'm sorry, Your Honor.
The district court brief?
The summary judgment motion.
Okay.
Trying to get to the background and make sure we're all on the same page here. Footnote 12, they specifically come in on behalf of DTNA and said, we're not pushing issues that require expert witness testimony. In our response to their summary judgment motion, we repeatedly raised on three or four different occasions, now if this requires expert witness testimony, we want discovery before the judge decides this motion. Then in their reply brief in support of their summary judgment motion, they again come back in part of the preemption argument and say, no. We're not getting into anything that requires expert witness testimony. So we were all on our side a little surprised when we got Judge Robinson's order that A, raised issues the parties did not raise in their briefing, specifically the consumer expectation test, and B, we were not given the opportunity to address those issues before she made the decision. It's something that I've never had happen before in my career. And I think it's important that we also look at the testimony of Mr. Jefferson that was relied upon in granting the summary judgment motion in favor of DTNA. His testimony was all over the ballpark. We pointed that out in our briefing that he said he was a loyal Freightliner customer and had been for a long time, that he got significant concessions. He even has testified that about a 50% price cut because of his history with Freightliner. He followed Freightliner's recommendations. He valued Freightliner's opinions. What DTNA latched onto is it says, well, he also said if Freightliner tried to force him to take this safety technology at issue in this case, forward collision warning and automatic emergency braking, that he would have looked elsewhere. Really? Because he wouldn't got the concessions from PACCAR or one of the other companies that he got from Freightliner. He's really going to go pay $80,000, $90,000 a year more for another truck if Freightliner...
What? Explain the connection between what you're saying and whether the consumer expectation test was satisfied.
Sure.
The connection is not obvious to me.
I'm talking right now about his testimony and the inferences she drew, Judge Robinson drew, from that testimony.
Now, you're talking about the warning claim or the design defect claim?
Both, actually.
Okay.
Because she relied on his testimony to grant summary judgment on both of those defect issues. Failure warn and design defect. And one of the things that we've argued here in our appellate briefing is she didn't appropriately apply the standard of review. These inferences should have been construed in our favor, not DTNA's favor.
Well, it would help me if you explain what element of either the warning claim or the design claim you're focusing on and what this evidence, what, in what way it's relevant to that element.
Sure, I'm happy to, Your Honor. She granted summary judgment in favor of Mr. Kleppner's client, first on the failure to warn claim by looking at what those of us who are old enough to remember called the open and obvious rule in Kansas. Namely, from the Heiner case and the Delaney case, those two individuals who were driving those tractors knew about the potential problems. They were aware of the hazards posed, and they nevertheless proceeded. And so, citing primarily Heiner, but also a little bit of Delaney, Judge Robinson on the failure to warn claim said, well, Mr. Jefferson and his driver knew the risks, so there was no reason that DTNA or Freightliner should have warned them. The problem with that is they focus on the testimony of Mr. Jefferson that, in his opinion, these trucks can be driven safely without this technology. The reality is these are not a driver aid. These are a safety net. Forward collision warning and automatic emergency braking, not a driver aid as much as it is a safety net for me, for you, and for every other driver on the Kansas highways.
I thought the materials that accompany this technology specifically says that it is a driver aid and that it does not purport to replace having an attentive driver.
That's exactly what it says in the first paragraph. And when you move on, it talks about the dangers posed by inattentive driving. And look, that's been recognized by courts in this country since the mid-1960s. Wrecks are inevitable. They're going to happen. They are foreseeable. And so this technology is not merely an aid, but a safety net.
Well, if the technology says it's only an aid, then and that's what the written record says, then I mean, what's your basis for contesting that and the ability to draw an inference based on that?
Sure. My basis for that, Your Honor, is the fact that this technology has been around for a long time. There are numerous carriers that have used it as standard equipment since 2011. In fact, on behalf of several of them. It is an aid, but the aid is a safety net for when the inevitable happens. Okay.
Well, the cases you're referring to that talk about the inevitability of accidents.
I'm sorry, again, sir?
The cases you're referring to that address the inevitability of accidents.
Sure.
Are those that protect people in the case of accidents, such as airbags and seatbelts?
Well, it started with the Larson case out of California back in 1968.
But that's the sort of thing they're talking about, that are there to protect people because accidents are inevitable.
Sure.
Okay. They're not cases involving this type of equipment, are they?
I would respectfully disagree.
Well, which cases does involve this type of equipment?
Sure. The recent case out of the Arizona courts, Varela, that overruled a prior decision because this type of safety technology, A, has not been preempted by NHTSA, and it's an important safety technology that may or may not protect the driver of a truck, but it's certainly going to protect those of us who are on the highway if that driver gets inattentive or is fooling around with his or her phone.
Is that a failure to warn or design defect case?
Both. In Kansas, they're really one and the same under the product liability statute. They're all subsumed into a product liability claim. Negligence, failure to warn, and the design and manufacturing defect issues.
Go ahead, Jim.
Okay. Thank you, Your Honor. So it starts with Larson in 1968, where the California Supreme Court said wrecks are inevitable. They're going to happen. No matter how safe you drive, we know they're going to happen. Automobiles, vehicles are designed to be driven on highways, and stuff happens. So then we jump forward to the Elmore case. I'm sorry, Larson was a Eighth Circuit case. Elmore in California involved a bystander who was injured, like this case. And I think that's an important distinction here that the district court overlooked. Our clients and their decedents had nothing to do with whether that truck was equipped with the safety technology to mitigate or perhaps even completely obviate this wreck. They had nothing to do with it. Unlike Heiner, unlike Delaney, unlike Wheeler and all of the other tractor rollback cases with the big heavy hay bales, this is a completely different animal. And for that reason, courts have been developing different tests for consumer expectation. Arizona, for example, completely eliminated consumer expectations for cases involving bystanders. There's a recent court case out of California in which the court decided the consumer expectation test had nothing to do with what the purchaser and user thought, but rather what people who'd be exposed to that particular machine lift would be exposed to in the warehouse where it was being used.
And are you advocating for a version of that sort of ordinary consumer?
Had we got to expert witness discovery? Absolutely.
Well, getting back to that question, I have a hard time seeing why you didn't waive that. I mean, you jointly stipulated to the that expert testimony would not be needed. When the motion for summary judgment was filed, where it was laid out bare for you what the arguments were going to be as related to warning defect and design defect, you didn't then claim, oh, we need expert testimony, Your Honor. You didn't file Rule 56D saying, oh, summary judgment is not appropriate because we need expert testimony. You didn't do any of that.
You're absolutely correct, and that's
so
because...
So why doesn't that equal waiver?
Because the decision that she made, Judge Robinson, on our design defect claim was totally based on her application of the consumer expectation test, which was never argued by any of the parties. How are we supposed to anticipate that the judge is going to resolve the case on an issue the parties did not raise?
So on how can a, on, a, on a warning defect claim, the idea of consumer expectations would not be baked in to the argument that's going to be made? What other argument did you make then?
I didn't make an argument.
What argument did they make that you responded to?
Sure. They made the argument, the old open and obvious rule. Just like in Delaney, just like in Heiner, here Jefferson and Ford knew that this risk was there if you didn't drive safely. And that's why on the failure to warn claim, the judge granted summary judgment. Then when she moved on to the design defect claim, she brings up consumer expectation when all that had been argued was that same thing, open and obvious, and then also they argued the optional equipment doctrine, which she failed to reach in her opinion, given what she already ruled. So here we are. We represent five innocent families, five people who died through no fault of their own. We agreed to a stipulation based on what we were told the motion would be, and that's what it was. I'm not here to make, you know, take any issue with Mr. Kleffner. He's a man of honor, and we're good friends. They briefed their motion for summary judgment. We didn't need expert testimony to respond to it. We responded. This is all as a matter of law. They filed their reply brief. Everything seemed kosher until we got the order.
Well, let me ask you this. What are you saying that the consumer expectation test is inapposite, is inapplicable to these kinds of claims?
Not necessarily.
Well, if the answer is not necessarily, then when the district court judge applies the law, the right law, how can you claim to be prejudiced? You should have known what the law was, shouldn't you?
I'm going to respectfully disagree.
And why is that?
Sure. It's because the motion did not put the consumer expectation test at issue. The motion put open and obvious in the testimony of Mr. Jefferson at issue. We're allowed, when under the Wheeler case, and I'm almost out of time, may I finish this point?
Yes.
Sure. We're allowed, if the consumer expectation test is in play, to present expert witness testimony, and we were prepared to do that. But it wasn't in play. They didn't raise it in their motion. And so we didn't feel like we needed to address it.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
Good morning, Your Honors, and may it please the Court.
Good morning, Mr. Kleppner. Did the district court unfairly apply the consumer expectation test here?
Not at all. It's part and parcel to a design defect. And we moved on design defect, and the consumer expectations test is the test in Kansas to evaluate that issue.
But on what basis did you argue you were entitled to summary judgment on the design defect claim?
Multiple. It's the same things that Judge Robinson decided on. Donnie Jefferson's testimony, which I can address as well.
Not the factual basis, the legal argument. Did you argue that the consumer expectation test was not satisfied?
Absolutely.
You did in the motion for summary judgment.
Absolutely. We moved on design defect and we moved on the warranty defect.
Just because that's the test for design defect doesn't mean that was the ground for your motion. And that's the point he's making. You moved for summary judgment on the design defect claim. In that motion, did you argue specifically that the consumer expectation test was not satisfied?
My recollection of what we argued in the summary judgment papers is we relied on Heiner. And Heiner, in the dicta there, said that the grant of summary judgment that was in Heiner on warnings could have effectively been found the same way under the consumer expectations test. So I know for sure we definitely cited Heiner in the summary judgment papers, and that issue was fully raised. But then, furthermore, they would have had a chance to respond to that. And so there was no unfair play here about consumer expectations. And in fact,
they would have had a chance to respond to your Heiner argument in their response to the motion for summary judgment.
That's correct, Your Honor.
But Heiner, that was a one-sentence statement that was effectively dicta, was it not?
It was, in fact, dicta. But then we argued that dicta.
You argued that you used that as a jumping off place to make a consumer expectation test argument.
We cited DeHeiner for sure.
Yes.
But in addition to that, we also cited Garst. Garst was a Kansas Supreme Court case. That was an issue where an excavation scraper lacked a shield over brakes. And in that case, it actually had air brakes like a truck did. And the issue in Garst was whether or not mud would accumulate in those brakes. And the allegation was it needed a shield to prevent that. And when the mud accumulated, what happened was that it would have decreased braking efficiency. Well, the Kansas Supreme Court there said, no, that's not unreasonably dangerous.
Because
the truck, or excuse me, in that case, the scraper could stop in an adequate distance.
Did it speak in terms of consumer expectations in ruling that way? The question is whether it was really, you can move on a number of grounds. If you moved on the basis, if you did not move on the basis that this was, that the truck satisfied consumer expectations, if you didn't argue that when expert testimony is relevant on that issue, and the judge ruled in your favor on that point you didn't argue, based on the evidence that had been presented with the motion in response to the motion, then it seems like it may be unfair to not allow the plaintiff to get expert testimony on the issue. That's what we're pursuing here.
I understand, think there's unfairness at all, and it's for the same reasons that Chief Judge Holmes stated. They knew what the case was about, and we did argue in that case, based upon the facts, that the consumer expectations test was not satisfied. At no point in time did they ever say, and in fact the footnote in their own briefing, and I think Mr. Rhodes said it again today, if we need expert testimony. Well, that's not for the district court to decide. That's for appellants to decide based upon what's in the briefing. They didn't invoke the rule, the 56 rule where they said we needed this. They didn't do any of that. It wasn't argued in the papers. At no point in time did they say, hold on, district court, we need expert testimony to support these.
What about after the court ruled, the district court ruled?
No.
In response to the order granting summary judgment, there was no motion for reconsideration?
Not at all. That argument didn't pop up until the briefs were submitted in this court. It never happened. So there was no unfair play. And my summary judgment motion is back there. I'd love to go find it, but we argued based upon the...
Is it in the record?
It is absolutely in the record, for sure. And so it will reflect what's there. And what I know we argued is that based upon Mr. Jefferson's testimony, Mr. Ford's testimony, based upon the manuals that Chief Judge Holmes talked about, based upon the fact that trucks are required to have air brakes pursuant to FMVSS, and based upon the fact that this truck had a functioning air brake system, it would never be more dangerous than what the ordinary consumer would believe. And that argument was front and center. And that's exactly what the district court did.
Was there agreement on who was the ordinary consumer at that stage?
We argued CDL licensed driver, and that's what the district court did. And they argued nothing to the contrary until it got to the appellate court. There was never a dispute in the summary judgment briefing about who the ordinary consumer was. So what I'd like to do with the 8 minutes I have is let's just address the two claims that are at issue. Starting with failure to warn. I believe that that district court's ruling is easily supported. And it's not based upon the same reasons that Mr. Rhodes said. The failure to warn dismissal was a simple and straightforward application of longstanding Kansas law that if the user knows of the risk, then there is no duty to warn. The uncontroverted facts on that issue were that both Mr. Jefferson and Mr. Ford, they were very aware of the risk of not stopping a truck in response to Ford traffic. Frankly, Your Honor, as teenagers, we know that. We know not to do that. But we're not dealing with teenagers here. We're dealing with individuals who are required to have the knowledge and the skills in this book. This is the Federal Motor Carrier Safety Regulations.
What does the complaint say, or perhaps the response to the motion for summary judgment, is the risk that they were not warned of? What was their theory?
Well, it certainly wasn't what they put in their appellate papers. What they put in the complaint was the failure to warn about the risk of not including automatic emergency braking, period.
That's a little different than from warning that you could cause an accident if you don't stop. It'd be warning of the danger of not having a backup in case you're inattentive.
Right.
Well, that's a little different from the way you described it. I'm not sure it makes a difference in the resolution of the case, but...
I don't think it does, because the warnings that they are just now on appeal claiming, number one, they say things like the safety net. And let me address this.
Let's start before you get to the arguments that you say are being raised for the first time on appeal. I think you said that in district court, they were arguing that it was failure to warn of the dangers from not having these devices.
Correct.
Okay. And your response is?
My response is that everybody in the record, it was uncontroverted that they knew of the danger. Well, it's not a danger to not have it. These individuals, Mr. Jefferson and Mr. Ford, were very aware of the fact that if you don't brake your truck.
But see, that's the point I was making. It's not the warning of the what happens if you don't brake your truck. It's warning of what happens if you don't have something to protect you in case you're not attentive at one point. That's what this is to protect you against. And I think you acknowledged that their argument was that there wasn't a warning of the danger from not having a backup system.
My response to that, Judge Hartz, would be that is indeed the risk that automatic emergency braking intends to address. It intends to address the risk, and there's many cases from this court that say warnings don't need to be granular in nature. In fact, this court has said that. And in fact, if the warnings need to get too granular, I can find the case, but it becomes impossible for the manufacturer. So the risk that's being addressed, I don't think we need to overcomplicate this. The risk that's being addressed is not braking in response to forward traffic. It's that simple. And that was what was addressed on summary judgment. That's been what's addressed now.
I would have thought you'd respond that, well, they knew what this device was supposed to do.
Oh,
they didn't even need to be warned about that.
Oh, for sure. They absolutely knew that.
That's not the way you responded, so I was wondering if maybe there's a problem with that.
No, no, there's not a problem with that. But in addition to what you just said, the gentleman had issued, Mr. Jefferson and Mr. Ford, they were very aware that this truck didn't have automatic emergency brake.
Under the legal framework, help me to understand, what is the connection between subjective knowledge of this harm or danger and the consumer expectation test? I mean, doesn't the subjective knowledge go to the open and obvious line of authority where the question is, to X person, it was open and obvious that this was a danger, therefore they didn't need to be warned? But that's different than the sort of objective analysis that goes under consumer expectations, is it not?
It is an objective test for sure, but that in this court's rulings on unreasonably dangerous, and I have a list here, have cited plaintiff testimony. It's not improper to say, and let's take Mr. Jefferson because that's the key example. The consumer expectations test, the tail, if you will, of that test talks about ordinary knowledge in the community. I may have got that a little bit off. If you take Mr. Jefferson, where did he get his information from? And if you do a pie chart, it's going to be a 12 to 16 slice pie because he gets his information from a variety of different sources within the community. The dealerships, Freightliner, DTNA, his drivers, himself. I can't think of a better cross-section of the community. So we can call his testimony subjective, but I would view it as a reflection, an objective reflection of what's out in the community.
Okay, let me go at it this way then. The way these tests generally work, it's one thing to say that testimony of Ford and Jefferson is it reflective of, an example of, what an ordinary consumer with a CDL driver would know. That's one thing. It's another thing to make it dispositive. And so what I'm saying is, in the ordinary consumer test or consumer expectation test, it just is a data point. It is a symbol of or reflective of what the ordinary consumer in this case would, what the knowledge they would have.
For sure. But that's not the only data point that was relied upon the district court.
Go on.
There were multiple data points.
But the point I'm making, I'm just trying to understand how it fits into the legal framework. Are you saying that this subjective knowledge is just should be viewed as a reflection of a fact basis for determining what the ordinary consumer would expect? Or are you saying that when I know that these two individuals would have known of the danger, that answers the question? That's determinative.
I don't say anything that Mr. Jefferson individually or Mr. Ford said individually is determinative. But when you take it together and combined with the knowledge and skills and the information that's what available in the community, which is what the district court did, when you take those things together and look at it, and I have to add, there wasn't any contrary evidence to this that was inserted into the record by appellants. Now, I know they're going to say expert testimony, but they had the same capability of controverting whatever Mr. Jefferson said, whatever Mr. Ford said, what the manuals said, the fact that the truck had a functioning air brake system, the fact that truck drivers, pursuant to these regulations, are required to have the knowledge and skills.
I'm confused about something. There were two claims. There's a failure to warn claim.
Correct.
And a design defect claim. The consumer expectation test relates to the design defect claim.
Absolutely.
For the warning claim, there's both an objective and subjective test. If the purchasers, in fact, had subjectively knowledge of this, that defeats the warning claim, does it not?
It does, because...
Because you were merging those two, and I thought you were saying that their subjective knowledge is irrelevant. It's irrelevant to the design defect claim. It's an essential element for the warning claim. Am I wrong about that?
You're correct on the warnings, and if I was merging those two, I apologize. The actual knowledge is a straightforward application of Kansas law. If they know of the risk, there is no duty to warn, but in addition to that, there is another component where if it would be apparent to an ordinary user, and the district court cited that in her opinion, and I think, frankly, it could have been upheld on that as well. If I might just make a final point for 30 seconds, I realize my time.
I'm going to give him a little time.
Understood.
Go ahead.
The final point I make is this. On the day of the accident, Mr. Kenny Ford had 1,100 feet of unobstructed roadway. After he had already passed billboards, signs, etc., alerting him to a hazard, which is a construction zone. That truck could have been safely slowed and stopped under those circumstances using the air brake system. Every other motorist in that line of traffic, including the decedents, were able to bring their cars to a slow stop. A truck with a functioning air brake system is a safe vehicle, period. And to hold otherwise would basically indict the hundreds of thousands of trucks on the road today. Thank you.
Thank you. If you want it, you have a minute and a half.
Thank you, Ron.
Yes, every other car and every other vehicle at that toll booth that day managed to stop. Why didn't Mr. Ford? Said he was inattentive, said he was reckless, he wasn't paying attention, it snuck up on him. That's all in the record. Guess what? Had that truck been equipped with forward collision warning, he would have been alerted that he was going too fast and he was too close to all of those vehicles that he ultimately ran into and ran over. Had this particular system had automatic emergency braking, the truck would have largely taken over and become somewhat autonomous. It would have applied the vehicle brakes. It would have applied the engine brakes. It would have woke up Mr. Ford. That's what this technology is for. It's to protect us. Okay, when I drive around in my SUV, I'm not a really big threat to another driver like somebody driving a 70,000-pound truck. It is ludicrous for my friend Mr. Kleffner to tell this court that a 70,000-pound truck barreling into stopped, slowed traffic at a toll booth is safe because it has air brakes. Then why in the world has the NTSB been begging the industry for years to make this technology standard? That's what this case is about. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Appreciate the arguments. Case is submitted.